Good afternoon, everyone. It is Monday, April 11th. We're finishing off the Economics and Social Justice in Jewish Law series with the topic of Tikkun Olam, which is one of the phrases that you find used, I think, really frequently amongst not only social justice advocates, but you find it used in synagogues all over the country, if not the entire world, as, you know, reasons for certain types of activism. So before we get to the actual sources here, quick survey. Anyone have any thoughts about what Tikkun Olam means in any way you wish to define it? None. Well, you're eating pizza, so that's a good excuse. So maybe Tikkun Olam is not eating with, and not talking with your mouth full. All right, that could count. I personally have seen Tikkun Olam used in a multitude of cases. What some would be in terms of political advocacy, that you have to support this particular cause, you have to show up to this protest in the name of Tikkun Olam. I've seen Tikkun Olam used for, in a more literal sense, of fixing the world, which is what Tikkun Olam technically means, to refer to maintenance of a building, like helping fix up neighborhoods. I've even seen written, in fact, when there was a group that did some volunteer work at my shul, they had a special blessing for Tikkun Olam, where they said, Asher Kedishana B'tzvotah B'tzivanu. I forget if it was Al Tikkun Olam or L'Takena Ta'olam, the exact nuance of the language there, but they actually put it in the form of a blessing, which is interesting because we actually don't have an explicit commandment to do Tikkun Olam, whatever that might be. And what I'd like to do today to describe Tikkun Olam is simply this. Since, you know, the term Tikkun Olam, meaning to fix the world or to repair the world, can mean so many different things to so many different people, and by definition of Olam has a very universalistic principle, what I'd like to do is go back, for lack of a better term, and examine the original intent. By which I mean, look at where did this term originate, the answer being in rabbinic Judaism, and to sort of extrapolate from the specific cases where it's used to try to see, well, what did Tikkun Olam mean to the people who coined the phrase? All right? Fairly, you know, safe, you know, way of defining the term. And I think, as you'll see towards the end, how it serves as a really nice closure to everything that we've been doing in this entire series. So, most of the sources for Tikkun Olam, it appears about 70-some-odd times in rabbinic literature, but sometimes the cases are duplicated. For the most part, you're going to find the sources in Tractate Gittin, mostly in the fourth chapter, one in the fifth I have here, and one in the ninth. We'll actually skip towards the end for the to do the first source, just to throw in an exception. It's a Tosefta, which is a Mishnaic era source, a Tannaitic era source. In Teruma 1:13, that says, if a miner tells someone in the marketplace, feed me from tithing, we feed him from Tikkun Olam. As we saw in the taxes and tzedakah class, when you have ma'aser ani, a special type of tithing, what we give to the poor people, that's something that only goes to, not only does it only have to go to a poor people, but it also specifically has to go to a Jew. And we discussed last week about giving charity towards non-Jews and the halachic status of that. But here you have a case, if you have a child that says, give me money from tithing, you give to him no questions asked because of Tikkun Olam. All right, and keep that in the back of your head. We'll sort of revisit that and to see how that fits into what I would consider to be a fairly decent pattern that you can find from the sources in Gittin. So let's start here with source number four, or you can just pass it along if someone isn't in the middle of eating. So I guess we'll start with David. Mishnah Gittin 4:2.
In former times, a man was allowed to bring together a base din wherever he was and cancel the get. Rabban Gamliel the Elder, however, laid down a rule that this should not be done so as for Tikkun Olam. Originally, the husband was allowed to give in the get an adopted name of himself or of his wife, or an adopted town of himself or of his wife. Rabban Gamliel the Elder made a regulation that he should write the male and so, or by whatever names he is known, the woman so-and-so, or by whatever is known for Tikkun Olam.
So in this Mishnah, we have two examples of when Tikkun Olam is employed. Now, keep in mind here, the way of Tikkun Olam isn't that we have a mitzvah of Tikkun Olam, but it seems to be a reason or the rationale given for a certain rabbinic enactment, meaning it is a motivation of however we define it. Not to say that, I mean, if Tikkun Olam was such a bigger idea, not only would you have found it, say, in the Bible in some form, but you would have also said something, we have an obligation to do, you know, this Tikkun Olam. just even in the language here, there are certain decrees that were made because of some tikkun olam, whatever that is. So what is it? So in the two cases here, one is normally, if I would be married, hypothetically, I wanted to divorce my wife, I could send a messenger to send the document of divorce to my wife, and while the guy was en route, I can get together a group of three guys as a beit din and say, that get that I sent is no longer valid. And Rabban Gamliel said, nope, can't do that anymore because of tikkun olam. That's case one. Case number two is in terms of using an adopted name. Instead, Rabban Gamliel changed the text of the get to say Ploni v'chol shum sheyeshlo, guy's name and every name that he has. All right. So let's start with case one. Case one is guy can send his wife a get, can theoretically retract it. Rabban Gamliel takes away that right. Any thoughts on how that's tikkun olam? Mm-hmm.
She goes ahead.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's actually explained a little bit more in the Gemara in terms of whatchamacallit. One is takanat mamzerim, as you put it, that if she gets married thinking that she is divorced, the kids are going to be mamzerim. A whole slew of issues with that. And another opinion is takanat agunot, is that otherwise you keep having her being chained, and you know, if he keeps doing this, you can have a case where no one's ever going to give a get. Or alternatively, if a beit din forces someone to give a get, which they could have done in those days in certain ways, he sends the get and then tries to annul it, then he sort of has enough to, he gives the get to say, okay, I'll send it, to get the first court off his back, and then he could just undo it completely and do this ad nauseum. Right? So Rabban Gamliel said, even though you may have a technical halachic right to do something, he made a decree to take away that right, because the only purpose for having this right is for abuse. Right? Where you already have, you know, in the Jewish divorce setup, the man really has all, if not most, of the power, and that the divorce is up to him to give. Here's a case where not only is he giving, but he's even manipulating the system for no purpose other than to really mess around his wife. Right? There's no other reason to do this other than out of spite. In case number two, you kind of have a similar motivation. There's actually an interesting sidebar here. The language used here is, Rabban Gamliel said that you write Ploni v'chol shum sheyeshlo. You write Ploni in every name the guy has. When I studied this with Rav Ben Chaim at YU, he made a distinction that in Ashkenazi writs of divorce, they will actually write down every single name the person has. Whereas in the Sephardi divorces, they will actually write the guy's name, comma, and in quotes, every name the guy has. Meaning, when Mishnaic literature, when you have this term ploni, it's basically fill in the blank here, not write every single alias he has, such that if you miss one alias, the divorce is invalid, but it's you write his main name, comma, and every name he has. Again, if you were going to use an alias in the writ of the divorce, you could just as easily say, that's not me. The only purpose you have in messing around with a get is basically to spite your wife, or soon-to-be ex-wife. Right? So that is one instance of tikkun olam used in Mishnah. Any questions? All right. Want to go back to you? Let's do source number two. This is Gittin 4.3.
What is referred to? Rabbi Yonahan said to illegitimacy.
No, source number two, 4.3.
Sorry. A widow has by rights no power to recover her ketubah from the property of orphans, save on taking an oath.
The rabbis, sorry.
The rabbis refrained from imposing an oath on her. Rabban Gamliel, the elder, thereupon made a regulation that she should take any vow which the orphans chose to impose on her, and so recover her ketubah. And similarly, witnesses sign their names to a get or tikkun olam. Halal, the elder, also instituted the prosbul or tikkun olam.
All right, we're going to hold off on the prosbul for sources number three. That's going to require a little bit more explanation here. So in Gittin 4.3, Mishnah and Gittin, you have a woman, when the husband dies, right, she there initially, I guess, the even though in order for her to take the property that's owed to her, she would have to take an oath saying that this is what she's deserved to, or that she didn't already take money off of the ketubah. The ketubah would be, say, the original rabbinic prenuptial agreement, that in the event of death and divorce, this is a certain amount of money that the woman is entitled to from the estate. However, the woman can take, since she's entitled to the money, she can also take money off of that in advance. So before she can fully collect, there was, you know, some idea of, like, well, maybe she'd have to swear for it in order, like, just to make sure that she didn't take in earlier. Rabban Gamliel said, no, made a regulation she should take any vow, that even though the rabbis didn't want her to take a vow, said anything that the orphans wanted to impose on her to cover the ksuba, fine. Similar, and it says, similarly, witnesses signed their names to forget me, make tikkun olam. One of the difficulties with these sources here is in terms of when you have a list of different actions that in the mission, this happens a couple of times here, what is the thing that tikkun olam really refers to? Does this, when it says mipnei tikkun olam, does that refer to, say, in the Mishnah, specifically to the last statement about witnesses signing documents for tikkun olam, or does that also extend to a woman giving an oath? Or at least compelling a woman to give a note that she didn't take any money from the estate previously. In either case, they're kind of related examples in that. Does anyone have any suggestions as to why forcing either compelling someone to give an oath that, you know, she's owed a certain amount of money or didn't take a certain, however you want to define that, and then to have witnesses sign on a document as a matter of tikkun olam? What do both of these things do? Witnesses signing a document and compelling a woman to give an oath. Now, keep in mind that giving an oath in the rabbinic era actually meant something. It's not like, you know, I affirm Yahweh's homie God and all the, yeah. Like, it actually was a really big deal. Any thoughts?
It's to prevent abuse again.
Yeah. Your main goal is to try to prevent fraud. Right? I mean, plain and simple, you are instituting a new obligation because according to the way the system could have worked, it would be fairly easy or fairly simple for someone to manipulate the pre-existing law for financial gain. If you automatically, if you don't compel a woman to take an oath in order to collect her ketubah, then there's really nothing to prevent any married woman from taking the money in advance. Husband dies and says, ah, you know, I'm still owed this for my ketubah. And no one's going to compel her to prove her case, right? That would be one case. And witnesses signing documents also, like here today, we have, you know, notaries. We have notaries for a reason, right? Because it's very, you know, not too hard to forge someone's signature. You put witnesses on a document, right? Then that has a much greater significance that even if something else might have technically worked, the possibility for fraud was so great, you have an additional decree or either a restriction in the first case of taking away a right, and here you have an additional obligation imposed on someone in order to prevent corruption. Right? Make sense? Does anyone think that I'm taking things too far out of context or not enough? Any thoughts so far? Cool. You're really agreeable for law students. All right. So now we get into the case of the Prisbal in section 3. It's the last line of the Mishnah, and I think when people, or at least in the yeshiva setting, think of tikkun olam, this is considered as really the prototypical, this is the example of what tikkun olam is. You want to take source number 3A?
This is the Prisbal. We've learned elsewhere, a Prisbal prevents the remission of debts in the sabbatical year. This is one of the regulations made by Hillel the Elder. Where he saw that people were unwilling to lend money to one another and disregarded the precept laid down in the Torah. Beware that there he not abase God in thine heart, saying, he therefore decided to institute the Prosbul. The text of the Prosbul is as follows. I hand over to you, so-and-so, the judges in such and such a place, my mother, that I may be able to recover any money owing to me from so-and-so at any time I shall desire. And the Prosbul was to be signed by the judges or witnesses.
All right, so in biblical law, we saw this a couple of weeks ago, I think. We have loans in Judaism, but every seventh year, at least the Shemitah year, not every seventh, well, depending on the law, but every Shemitah year, loans are erased completely. And there's an explicit biblical admonition saying, do not withhold from lending your money even if Shemitah is approaching. What was the problem? People were withholding their money from lending as Shemitah was approaching. So Hillel instituted this Prosbul, which effectively transferred the debt not to the individual, but to the Beit Din. We couldn't argue about the legalities, you know, in detail, but it kind of said, instead of me owing you money, it's I now owe the Beit Din money, and they're going to sort of collect on my behalf. half, and the biblical nullification of loans is really only on the individual loans, not say on a corporate loan or this institutional loan. I could be using, you know, poor legal terms, but that's in essence how it works. Now let's think about this for a second here before we get to, you know, an additional statement of the Gemara. You have a case where the Torah mandates people to lend money at a certain time. The lenders, the people with the capital, weren't doing what they were supposed to, and so Hillel sets up this takana. How is this a matter of tikkun olam? And who do you think is really benefiting from this exchange? Now keep in mind, what Hillel is doing, and the Gemara discusses this, is he's sort of undoing something that's in the Torah, right? Because the Torah says, here's what's supposed to happen. Hillel's now coming up with a way for people to skirt around the Torah. How is that tikkun olam? Any idea? Yeah.
I mean, it's supposed to be by opening the
Dal Pnei Halavim. You don't want to close the door in front of the bars. Yeah.
You know, a huge risk, essentially, that
going
to lend money and people will be able to
borrow. So here, the Tikkun Olam, and based on what you said from the Gemara, is the people who borrow are now going to have accessible liquidity. But are they the ones who are directly benefiting from this Takana? That's stage two. Who's benefiting stage one?
I mean, you're presupposing that they're already, you know, in order for them to be the ones benefiting. I mean, if the stage one is that there were no outstanding loans.
Oh, I would.
Therefore, that's the.
I would disagree. It doesn't imply outstanding loans. Talking about, let's say it's a week before Shemitah, right? Someone says, can I borrow $1,000? You have that biblical obligation to lend them money.
Right. So, the extent that people are following it, so then yes, it obviously. Benefits the lender.
Right. So the answer, really, is that a benefit?
Practice, we've seen that it seems to be that they weren't actually lending.
Well, I would argue that Prusbel actually benefits both parties. Take 3b, and we actually see this explicitly in the Gemara on 36b to 36a.
What is the meaning of the word Prusbel? Rabbi Gispa says, Prus Uli Ubuli, Uli means the rich, as it is written, and I will break the pride of your power. And Rabbi Joseph explained, these are the Bulaot in Judah. Uli means the poor, as it is written, thou shalt surely lend them sufficient.
And I included in Hebrew the Rashi, it says, Buli Ubuti, Ashirim Va'aniim, it refers to the wealthy and the poor. Ashirim Shelo Yafsidu, the wealthy so that they wouldn't lose money. Va'aniim Shelo Yinalu Delek Bifneihem, and the poor so that the door wouldn't be shut in front of their face. Right, so you have a case here of this idea of Prusbel, which I think, if you just look at it face value, it's like, oh, we're trying to help the poor get money. But it's not just about the poor, it's also about helping the wealthy. Because the poor could just as easily manipulate the system. If they know, I have a biblical obligation to lend you money, even though it's right before Shemitah, there's nothing to prevent a poor person from coming up to me, say, a day before the clock would start that the loan would have to be annulled, and say, lend me 25 grand. Knowing that I have to give him the money, and knowing that 2 days later, he won't have to pay it back, right? So it's not just so much that there is, you know, people weren't following the law, but here you have a case where a law could easily have been manipulated by, you know, could be manipulated by one side. By setting up this Prusbel, you kind of you sort of rebalance the equation. Right, you come up with a solution that neither side comes out behind. You've got two legitimate interests here. Lenders who want to make sure that they get their money back, or at least don't want to get shafted 2 days before Shemitah is going to start. And you've got the borrowers who need to make sure that they've got some accessible capital. Right, so this type of solution, as a tikkun olam, is one that takes the legitimate interests of two parties and comes up with an equitable solution. All right, take source number four. Yeah?
Sorry. If a man makes his slave security for another man and he emancipates him, in strict justice, the slave is not liable for anything. Tikkun olam, his master is compelled to emancipate him. And he gives a bond for his purchase price. Rabbi Song
O'Neill
says that he does not give a bond, but he emancipates him.
All right. So if you put your slave as a as collateral, meaning treating the slave as property, then technically you don't have to redeem him at all. But Yupnei Tikkun Olam, you actually force him to do so and to make him free. All right. Now, but here's the other thing: the Kotev Shtar Al Damav. But you also write sort of a document for his purchase price. In other words, if you use a person as collateral, right? Not only do you have to buy him back, but you also have to free him afterwards. Any ideas as to why that's tikkun olam? Nothing? All right, well, here's one possibility. In Jewish law, when you have a slave, or at least in this sort of sense, refers to a Canaanite slave, not a Jewish slave, where the slave would have to convert almost halfway towards Judaism, would still be obligated in certain commandments. If you have a debt and you sell this person out as an individual, right, in terms of, say, bringing this selling him to a different master, it doesn't even say here specifically if it's to Jewish or non-Jewish, it certainly is going to impact to some degree what his observance level is going to be. You could also theoretically throw out some other ideas of, well, let's say, you know, the guy had a family. Right. Let's technically the owner, or at least the owner of the slave, would be an owner of the, you know, wife and children as well. Right. Separating him, you could also see as a matter of, you know, completely dehumanizing in a certain way of, you know, separating all family bonds. Not unlike, say, what happened in this country a couple hundred years ago. Right. Again, there's a certain case here. If we're going to impose a certain penalty on you, if you're going to act in a certain way of an abuse of power. When you have that much control over an individual and you're starting to abuse it. Take source number 5.
One who is half a slave and half free works for his master and for himself on alternate days. This is the ruin of your fellow. The Talmud said, you have made matters right for the master, but not for the slave. Possible for him to marry a female slave because he's already half free. It is impossible for him to marry a free woman because he's half a slave. Shall he then remain unmarried? But was not the world only made to be populated, as it says? He created it not a waste, he formed it to be inhabited. For tikkun olam, therefore, his masters compelled to liberate him, a bond for half his purchase price. Beit Hillel thereupon retracted their opinion and ruled over Beit Shammai.
It's one of the few cases where we follow Beit Shammai over Beit Hillel. Because a slave is considered property, you in theory could have two owners of one slave. So if one person frees his half of the slave, right? So according to Hillel, it's like, oh, he can just simply, purely from an economic standpoint, he'll work half the time and he'll be free half the time. Beit Shammai adds in, no, that doesn't really work, or at least you satisfy the master, but the slave is now in an untenable situation. Because if you're a slave, you can be married to another, to a female slave, but if you're free, you can marry someone free, you don't go the other way, you can't mix and match. In which case, how is this person going to live? And so Hillel gave a suggestion that does at the surface seem equitable, right? Because someone freed him, oh, half free, half slave. Shammai says, no, there's an additional component here where if you maintain the status quo, you've created an unjust system where the slave is now caught in the middle. And the answer is, you force the other guy to sell him, you don't force the other guy to sell him, you, basically, you're forced, the other guy is forced to free him, and he gets his money's worth, which is fantastic for two reasons. One is by ultimately freeing him completely, he's now free to marry whomever he wants, and you no longer keep him in this halachic limbo state of being impossible to be married. On the other hand, the guy who has legitimate ownership isn't penalized either. He doesn't take a loss at it, right? So you have a case here of one, potential injustice. You have a solution that's given out of tikkun olam that takes care of the legitimate needs of all interested parties. For the slave, he gets free, so now he can marry. And for the guy who owned the other half, you don't force him to take a loss because of tikkun olam, because he still has that legitimate share of ownership, so he gets his money back too. Now, yes, he might not have wanted to sell, right? Which you could say, well, that's out of tikkun olam, but this is where the gezeirah of tikkun olam comes in, that there is an unjust situation, but we're also not going to penalize a third party when he has a legitimate interest there as well. So you've got a really, you know, I think a compromise here. Take source number 6. This is Mishnah Gittin 4:6.
Yes. Captives should not be redeemed for more than their value for tikkun olam. Captives should not be helped to escape for tikkun olam. Rav Shimon Gamliel says that the reason is to prevent the ill treatment of fellow captives. Neither should the scrolls of the law, phylacteries, and scissors be bought for heathens for more than their value for tikkun olam.
All right, any thoughts on this one here? Captives not being redeemed for more than their value. Captives not being helped to escape. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that's because of the people who are left. Or buying Torahs, tefillin, and mezuzot from non-Jews for tikkun olam. Any thoughts on what this means? And how does this tikkun olam?
Not incentivizing them to, you know, capture more people or steal more.
Bingo. You don't want to, if people know that, well, and this actually, you know, came up, you know, in our history of, you know, people getting captured, great rabbis getting captured, and someone comes along and, you know, says, oh, you know, we want a ransom. It's like, no, because once people realize, oh, we can kidnap, you know, this guy, we're going to get a whole lot more in return, again, as you put it, you incentivize kidnapping. We have specifically here helping someone escape. You don't do, because of tikkun olam for everyone else who's there. And for Torah, tefillin, and mezuzot, I know a question comes up a lot of, can you buy a sefer Torah on eBay if you're not really sure where it is? You don't want to set up a scenario where, hey, Jews will pay top dollar for this, so I'm not going to start mugging Jews. So how is that tikkun olam in terms of not incentivizing bad behavior? Who's being affected in this case? Usually an unknown third party. Right? You're not even talking here, I mean, with the exception here about the captives or that, it seems kind of weird to say that we're not going to help someone get free because of tikkun olam. But it also helps you show just the encompassing value of what tikkun olam really is. You have to think beyond the interests of one particular group of society and to see what are the effects you're going to have on the greater good. Right? If you, you know, as convoluted as might seem, well, someone's captive, you have to do whatever it takes to free him. But what's the effect going to be? What's going to be that stage two? If through your actions, you're going to cause someone else to be kidnapped, that's not really tikkun olam. You've just done a trade. Right? And if through helping one person leave slavery, you've made life worse for a whole lot of other people, or not slavery, captivity, you've made life worse for a whole lot of other people, have you really done tikkun olam? You've only exchanged one person's suffering for another person's suffering. That's not tikkun olam. Now, as sad as it might seem to say, well, we can't do anything about it, it's sort of like a Sophie's choice here. According to this here for tikkun olam, is realizing that there's going to be an effect to your actions and realizing that you can't help one person at the expense of someone else when there's a legitimate interest and a legitimate need there. Because, look, the other captives aren't, you know, you're going to say that one person's life is more worth someone else's, that you'll free one and someone else is, because they're free, someone else is now deserving of, you know, a more severe punishment, right? Or to say that, well, I'm going to buy back this sefer Torah for my shul, so that means that another shul can get broken into and have their sefer Torah stolen, if that's what the end result is going to be through incentivizing stuff. And it kind of shows that tikkun olam doesn't just mean, you know, repairing the world. It means sort of thinking beyond your limited sphere and to see, well, what are the consequences? Who else is going to be affected by it? And are those consequences, or at least are the people going to be affected, have, you know, would have a legitimate gripe as to, well, why are you helping out one person specifically at my expense? I want to take source number 7.
Pretty serious exceptions, at least in the case of food.
Yeah.
Right, in terms of your immediate family, personal, you know, yourself, your wife, and all that stuff, you are allowed to sort of spend whatever, you know, is required.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how does that factor sort of, you know, is that, if, well, I'm in the stranger context, but if yourself, you are, you certainly have the one that's enough for yourself.
In terms of... Right, but in terms of, like, obligations that you... Well, so there are certain obligations that you have by way of your own family.
Right.
Which would, you could say, supersede that of, you know, the greater social good type of thing. In that it's sort of, there's a general law of pidyon shivuyim, a general law of redeeming captives, and then there are separate laws that an individual has to his family.
Sure.
And then that's how I would make that distinction. Meaning when you're talking about redeeming captives in the broader scheme, here's how it's supposed to work. But if you have obligations to your family, that's different. Like we also saw last week with healthcare, right? Providing healthcare, there's a difference between, say, providing healthcare to random people and providing healthcare to your wife, right? There's certain obligations that you have as a head of a household. All right, so that's where I would make that distinction. And that's not a matter of pidyon shvuyim as much as a matter of here are the things that you have to do as a member of your, the head of your household family. I want to take source number 7.
If a man divorces his wife because of ill faith, he must not remarry her. Because she makes a vow, he must not remarry her. The Yehuda says, if he divorces her for vows which he made publicly, he may not remarry her. But for vows which he did not make publicly, he may remarry her.
Yeah, so these are different reasons for why divorce and certain reasons why you can get remarried. The tikkun olam comes at the last case, though, but figure include them all here.
So the mayor says if he divorces her for a vow which requires the investigation of the city not remarry her, but if for one which does not require the man to not divorce you, divorce her, and the city is permitted to remarry her, all this would be an olam.
Right, sure. So, well, the all this is really more of the, whatchamacallit. The all this, there's really the addition of the, I think it was the Sincino translation here, but the last line is v'tirilo chachamim she'afsirena v'pnei tikkun olam, that there was a certain situation where even though by strict law the husband shouldn't have been allowed to divorce his wife, sages gave a dispensation because of tikkun olam. Now, how is it tikkun olam to allow one person to remarry a wife that he divorced? For that reason. Any thoughts on that? None? Huh. This is an interesting question, like how allowing one guy to get remarried again. It's a little hard to extrapolate from here whether or not this is a universalistic case or like in just this one particular instance. But you could maybe argue that when someone says, you know, I guess people can get divorced in the heat of the moment. Today the divorce process generally takes a long time, you know, hire a scribe and all that, you know, it gets really complicated. You could get divorced in the heat of the moment, and it could very well be that the sages said, well, you know what, for tikkun olam, because we want to sort of have peace between people, we're going to sort of, in a way, let this guy's, you know, not a rational statement, but a statement that might have been said through a rationality slide. Right? People say a lot of things, you know, when they get into fights with their spouses. Right? And some of them, you know, might have a halachic, you know, real severe halachic implications. Getting remarried, right? Well, sure, you know, if they want to get back together, right? You can maybe see, like, why, you know, the sages might want to say, well, you know what, in this particular case, we're going to let it go because of tikkun olam and sort of take care of the nulling of the vow. In the back, take number 8, please, Mishnah Gittin 4:9. So those wrap up all of the tikkun olam. I'm sorry, go ahead, 4:9.
If a man sells his field to a heathen, he has to buy yearly the first fruits from him and bring them to the Yerushalayim for the tikkun olam. To deter people from selling their land to heathens or to stimulate them to redeem it if they have sold it.
Right, that's the, whatchamacallit, that's the IE part is the Cincino's commentary here. It's an interesting case that comes up, especially these days with Shemitah about selling the land of Israel. You have to bring the first fruits to Jerusalem. So you can think, well, maybe I could get around giving the first fruits to Jerusalem by selling my land to a non-Jew, and then I'd be exempt. And then, you know, buy it back, and then everything's fine. So the Mishnah says here that if you do that, you have to, whatchamacallit, you still have to bring them first fruits anyway, meaning you try to do a legal loophole to exempt yourself, and you still have to pay for it anyway. How is this tikkun olam? Well, you sort of, there seems to be a practice here that people just didn't want you to do in terms of selling the land to non-Jews to get out of fulfilling your requirement. By taking away your incentive, right, if you're still going to have to pay anyway, then there's no point. So once there's no point, you're not going to do it, and therefore it's a way of preventing you from causing more trouble. Source number 9, please. Now we're up to Gittin 5:3.
As for the betterment of property during multiple tenure, and payment for the maintenance by a man's heirs of his widow and daughters is not enforced for mortgage property for tikkun olam. The finder of a lost article cannot be required to take an oath for tikkun olam.
Alright, so the first part is if you've got property that's mortgage, meaning there's something that has a lien on it, you don't take money from that property for the purposes of tikkun olam for certain, even for certain types of obligations. Any thoughts on using money from mortgage property in tikkun olam?
It's not your money.
Yeah. Simply put, like, it's something that's owed to someone else. It's, you know, seems pretty simple. You can think, well, even though it's yours, but someone else has a lien on it, it's not entirely yours. And once you start giving away someone else's money, you know, you kind of don't have a really good society there. Now I'll finish it off here with source number 10. Following three bills of divorce are invalid, but if a woman marries on them, the child born of such a marriage is legitimate. One, if the husband wrote it with his own hand, but it was attested by no witnesses. Two, if there was a witness but no date. Three, if it has a date but the signature of one witness. These two bills of divorce are invalid, but if she marries, the child is legitimate, meaning the child is not a mamzer and can still marry any other Jew. Rabbi Lazar, however, says that even though it was not attested by witnesses at all, so long as he gave it to her in the presence of witnesses, it is valid, and on the strength of it, she may recover ketubah and mortgage property. Since the signatures of witnesses are required on the get for tikkun olam, and we saw that a little bit earlier regarding contracts in general, here we see that really Elazar says, since the signatures on the get itself are only for tikkun olam, then if as long as it was given to her in front of witnesses, then it's still fine. So we see that even this thing of tikkun olam, even though there's an original intent, right, if it's not necessarily met, it doesn't invalidate what it's supposed to address. Meaning if there's an additional requirement on there. So the way that I've seen tikkun olam is that it has two functions in the rabbinic literature based on the usages. One is that it prevents corruption or prevents abuse of a system. And two, it's a way to solve a problem to address the legitimate needs of two interested legitimate parties. Right? We saw that, you know, the first one we saw in the case of witnesses to prevent fraud. But again, even in Rav Elazar's case here, he says about witnesses signing the get. He doesn't say you don't need witnesses at all. He says only the witnesses on the get were for tikkun olam. You still need witnesses to have something hold up in court. Right? The prusbul would be a good example of both. It's a way of taking away the possibility of corruption while at the same time maintaining the legitimate interests of both the borrower and the lender. So we think today about what tikkun olam is in terms of, you know, extending it to, say, maintaining what is the optimal social order. As we've been discussing here for the past six, you know, this is week seven, it's not about social justice, as I understand it, in the halakhic system, isn't about helping one segment of the population. It's what is the greatest social good, not defined by the greatest good for the greatest number of people, but when you've got when you have two legitimate arguments or two legitimate claims to something, how do you come up with a compromise where both legitimate needs are satisfied? We saw in weeks one and two, we're not entirely capitalistic and we're not entirely socialistic, but we do have elements of both. We saw for labor laws that just as, you know, an employer has to treat a worker with certain provisions, so too the worker has certain expectations for what he gives back to the employer in terms of maximizing efficiency. When we talk about charity and social welfare programs, we saw that, yes, individuals do have a right to support the poor, but the poor have an obligation to the rest of society as well. It's not a one-sided equation here where social justice is not purely about helping the poor, even though that's obviously an important component, but it's really only half the story. Really, as I see it in social justice and halakha, it's more of how does this all work together? And, you know, how do we balance, you know, the needs of the poor, right? And don't want anyone to come up with the impression that they're any way to be minimized or discounted, but without, say, turning Judaism into a welfare state, which it never really promoted. Right? And to try to get across this balance, I think, is certainly a worthwhile endeavor. And I'd also like to now thank David Parachoki for bringing me in for the past few weeks in doing this. And good luck with the rest of the semester. Have a happy Pesach. And I guess we can work on, if we can do it for next year, that would be awesome. Offer requests too. But we'll be in touch over that. So, and thank you all very much for coming in week out.
Thank you. Well,